slowly, slowly approach, you know. And it's about putting yourself out there and saying, hey, I want to learn more. I want to learn more. Can you explain this to me? Doing the extra hours. I think that, like, you know, the culture of counting hours, I think, stunts growth. And I feel like a lot of people want to count their hours at home when they're doing research or learning or whatever it might be. But all you're doing is investing in your future.
Yeah. Welcome to A Table for Two, inspiring and educational interviews and stories with the best operators, owners, and entrepreneurs in business and the hospitality industry. My name is Phil Halani, and on today's episode, we chat to Tony Pantano, partner and chief operating officer of Only Hospitality Group. Tony's journey in hospitality started at the age of 13, working in an Italian restaurant in Lygon Street, Melbourne. After finishing high school, he managed several venues while also completing his university degree. He joined hospitality software company called My Guest List, which took him to New York, where he would later join Bluestone Lane, an Australian-inspired coffee shop, as general manager of the flagship store that has now grown to 17 stores across America. He was then offered a unique position as chief steward aboard a 50-meter super yacht, which took him to 30 countries, including some of the most remote locations in the world. After getting homesick, he decided to move back to Melbourne with the goal of working with Julian and the Only Hospitality Group as general manager, which has now grown to over 15 locations, which includes cafes, roastery, a pub, and restaurants. Tony is now chief operating officer at Only Hospitality, which is Melbourne's largest non-franchised cafe group. A quick shout out to our good friends at Procow Dairies, Sonoma Baking Co. and MD Providors, who are passionate about supporting small businesses, the hospitality industry, and also this podcast. So we have Tony Pantano from Only Hospitality Group. Thanks for joining us, Tony.
Mate, thanks for having me. Absolute pleasure.
It's no, thank you, man. I've you know, obviously I've been following your journey for a while since I met Julian, and you guys have just created something so special. So I wanted to get you on. Obviously you started off as a general manager, you're chief operating officer now, and we'll talk more about that. But what I'd love to know is, talk to us about the start of your journey of hospitality. You started at 13 on Lygon Street. Can you talk to us about that?
I did. So I used to play junior football with Nicholas Dimatina, who's the son of Frank Dimatina, who ex-Richmond footballer has owned a bunch of different restaurants, and he had this restaurant, Il Gambero, on Lygon Street. And when we were like sort of 13, Nick started talking at footy training. He's like, oh, I'm going to go work at my dad's pizza restaurant on the weekend. And I was like, can I come? Like, and I was just like, I just thought it'd be just fun.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I guess so. So we went in, and it was the Lygon Street Festa was the first weekend. And back then it was massive. Like, you know, the whole street was blocked off, and everyone from Melbourne, the Italian community in Melbourne, really went in there and really enjoyed in the festivities. But I started working there and mate, just kept going one week after another, every Saturday night down there. And I spent sort of 3 or 4 years doing that, actually, on Lygon Street, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Lygon, and back in the day as well, Lygon Street was the place to be, right? Like it was always.
Oh, mate.
So
it was the best. It was the best. It's, yeah, it's a very different place now, but it was unbelievable. And just, it was so busy, and, you know, Grand Prix weekend was unbelievable. And, yeah, really good place, really good place, a really good destinational place for the families to go out for a meal. You know, I feel like people used to go out for a meal a lot more for dinner, just for a spontaneous family dinner, whereas probably now it's more of the, particularly in the times now, the Uber Eats at home or the special meal delivered at home. But, yeah, it was a great place. I love Lygon Street.
Yeah, you look at the photos of back in the day in Lygon Street, it's pretty special. So what during that period, of essentially from 13 to 18, where you were working, you worked there, you worked at a pizza shop after that.
Yep.
What did that teach you about hospitality, that period?
I'll tell you, the first thing it taught me is how to talk to people and how to communicate with adults, because I was serving adults all the time. And the old school hospitality way was, you know, treat every customer as if they're coming into your home, because it was, you know, the success of the venue was their livelihood, and that's what put food on their table. So the thing I learned most is how to make people's experience special and memorable. And even if you made a mistake or something went wrong, how to try and fix it and never leave a bad taste in someone's mouth. Really fond memories of that sort of era.
Yeah, I love that. And you're 100% right. Those early days really, really teach you about hospitality and how to talk to people. And I think it should be compulsory. Everyone should do hospitality at least one point in their life, because it really kind of, you know, it teaches you so many life skills, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And like, you know, it's even different now at homes. Like, you know, no one has a home phone. And as a kid, I always got taught answer the phone, you know, hello, Pantano residents, this is Tony speaking. Like, I got taught that as a kid. But now no one has a home phone. It's just a mobile phone, and kids have a mobile phone from sort of, you know, 10 years old or whatever it is. I don't even know. But, yeah, you know, from a younger age, I think communication is a really important skill that people need to have, because no matter what you choose to do, whether you're a tradie or economist or whatever it might be later in life, you need to be able to communicate.
Yeah,
and do it articulately.
100%. And hospitality helps with that so much. What was your – talk to us about your journey from 18 onwards. You did go to university, but you've said previously that you dropped out.
Yeah, so I finished high school and I went into an international business degree, and I thought, you know, I'll get into that. And I got to uni and I was just like, what is this? I was like, this is absolutely not for me. It was like numbers and spreadsheets and calculations, like, whoa, this is just not how my brain works. So I did one semester in that, and then I got back in. I went and worked for my cousin at Blake's Feast up at Mount Hotham. Did a season up there, learned how to snowboard, pulled beers, and had a lot of fun. And that was probably almost like a mini gap year sort of thing. And then I came back the year later, and I went to Swinburne, and I did a media and communications degree. And at the same time, I went back and worked for the Dimatina family, and I managed Dimatina's restaurant while doing my degree. I mean, my degree, I think, had 9 contact hours a week or something like that. So I was working full-time and doing my degree. But I had a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
And what, I mean, I guess, at what point did you feel you wanted to make hospitality a career? Was it during that period, or was it more later on?
No, it was... I always wanted to remain in the industry, but I think when I got to sort of probably 24 or thereabouts, I sort of was like, oh, I don't want to do the hospo hours. You know, I don't want to do the 2 a.m. finishes and all that sort of stuff. You know, I was probably looking at trying to find a wife and all sorts of different, you know, things that you think you have to do in your mid-20s. And I got a sales job. I went in and I got a sales job selling hospitality software, actually. Worked for a company called My Guest List, which is database management, marketing and communications. And I then started selling that product to venues in Melbourne and Sydney and eventually New York. And when I got to New York and I was selling this product, I was inspired by the industry again. I was like, whoa. I was like, New York, you know, Manhattan's just like a different level of hospitality. And I was like, nah, this is where I want to be.
Wow.
And then I made that move back into hospitality, and I guess the rest is sort of history. And I had a conversation with Julian just last week, and I was like, what do you reckon we'll be doing when we're 50? And he's like, I don't know, this. And I was like, yeah, probably. Yeah. You know, something bigger and better. I mean, I said to him, I've got a dream to open a hotel one day. That's something I really want to do, but I think hospitality is—it's innate in me, and it won't change.
And you guys have got yourself, and we'll talk more about your journey with the group. But you guys have got yourself to a point now where you guys are having a lot, working really hard, but having a lot of fun and doing that. So, talk to us about that. Talk to us about that New York experience. So you head to New York to learn to work with My Guest List, which is like database technology company. When was it that you said that you made that decision, you want to be in hospitality? When was it that you went to Bluestone Lane?
My Guest List, we made some really great inroads over there in New York and Vegas and LA and everything else like that. But we were having tremendous success in Australia at the time. And there was a decision to try and get me to move home to Australia to rejoin the sales team in Australia. And I just wasn't ready. I just wasn't ready to come home from New York because I just felt like my journey there wasn't done.
How old were you? How old were you at this point?
I'm going to say 26.
26,
thereabouts. So, you know, I've sort of been in New York for 12 months or 18 months at that stage. And then Bluestone Lane was sort of popping up. And I was actually like, these Aussie dudes are opening up a cafe. And I just went and knocked on the door. And I was like, hey, like, actually, no, I was trying to sell them my guest list. That's what happened. And that's how I met them. And then I was like, oh, you're opening a cafe? I was like, I'll come and help out on opening day. I was like, it'll be fun. I'll come and wait tables. And then it just so transpired, the timing worked out that they wanted me to go back to Melbourne, and this opportunity was presenting itself. I was like, yeah, I'll work here. And that was the Greenwich store, and it sort of took off. You know, it became the destinational cafe in Manhattan, you know, on the corner of Greenwich and Perry. And, you know, Perry's where the Sex and the City steps are. So, you know, every Aussie that came to New York, they'd do the, you know, the Sex and the City tour and then come to Bluestone for an avocado smash and a flat white. Mm. And look, I had an amazing time there. It was a lot of fun. Worked with some great, made some lifelong friends there and worked with some great people. And it was a little slice of home in America. So it was challenging. The educational process of getting Americans to understand the Australian cafe culture was challenging. But it's you know, they're having tremendous success, and it's a really good experience in my time.
Yeah, I want to touch on a little bit about Bluestone Lane. Why do you think it was? Firstly, why do you think it was such a success, or was it an instant success, or did it take time for Bluestone Lane to be a hit?
They always had good success from the start because the customer service was at a high standard. You know, there was great customer engagement because it was Aussies working in the store. So, you know, the first two stores that they opened were in basements of or bases of office buildings. And they were small. I'd say they're probably 25 square meters. I mean, wow. I might be wrong, but it was just about having the culture. It developed a culture of go down, have a coffee, chat to the barista, much the same as you chat to the bartender at a bar. In America, the culture of you go to a bar, you sit at the bar and you go on your own and you have a steak and watch the baseball, you know, that's a common thing to do. So I think that people started to draw the similarities to that. And look, I think the decor really made a contribution. The communication with the patrons was, you know, it was an Aussie serving you. And, you know, there's definitely an element of, oh, we love the Aussie accent over there. And that made a big difference. And then the coffee and the product was good. And I think some hard work really contributed to their success.
Yeah, I found, because I went to New York a few times or America a few times before I visited Bluestone Lane, and I never enjoyed the breakfast there. I never really enjoyed the coffee there. If it wasn't Starbucks, I mean, obviously there's Stumpton Coffee and Blue Bottle, but the overall cafe experience, it was very rare to find the Bluestone Lane experience. Do you think it was because Australians are so good at what they do, they brought it to America and it just exploded?
Yeah, I also think it coincided with a big movement of Australians to America.
Okay.
You know, if you look back probably 10 years ago, it was London. You know, every Aussie went to London. And then it was, you know, New York became the destination. Every Aussie wanted to go to New York or LA. So I think it coincided at the right time. And I also think that, you know, there was other players in the market that came into the market, like True Hands, for example. You know, I think they've got four stores now. You know, Grant Smiley went to LA, took Australian hospitality to LA. Curtis Stone went over to America and sort of took off. I think it was just a bit of a wave at one time, and the all of a sudden the Australian hospo culture started to filter in. I mean, I remember my first breakfast I've had in New York was at IHOP, and it was like pancakes and bacon and whipped cream on top, and I was like, whoa, what's this heart attack I'm about to have?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was also the freshness element. People eating a fresh breakfast or brunch was something new.
Yeah, 100%. And they definitely made that movement. You're right, the Aussies started going. It was a good thing with timing and whatnot, wasn't it? Timing was a big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Nick had been working at ANZ over there for a little while too. So, I mean, everyone in the ANZ office obviously supported it, and it's just a, you know, Your biggest marketing tool is the people that talk about you, and if they have a good experience, it's, you know, one it'll just keep spreading.
And talking about Nick, before we move on from Bluestone, talking about Nick, you obviously work with a great entrepreneur, restaurateur here with Julian. What are your thoughts? I mean, Bluestone Lane's exploded. There's, I think, over 30 stores now or something like that in America. What was it? Why? What made him so successful? Why was he such a good leader?
I think, you know, I think Julian and Nick have similar qualities where their attention to the financial detail is what makes them successful. So there was, and I had never understood, to be frank with you, I had never really understood the financial side of a hospitality business until I started at Bluestone, and I just got a taste for it. And then when I obviously came in and joined Julian, with Julian, I got a greater understanding of that. I think attention to detail on the financial side of things, because it's not about the quantum dollars, it's about the percentages. And I think if you look after the percentages, that makes a really big difference. And the power of positivity. You know, the power of positivity is really important. And that's with any leader. You know, it's whether you're a footy coach, a hospitality entrepreneur, or you know, you're an electrician, you know, you've got to be positive, because at the end of the day, people want to be around positive people, and positivity is contagious.
Yeah, I love that. And you're spot on with that. And obviously Bluestone's gone crazy. What made you leave? What made you go from Bluestone? You mentioned that you had a bit of a gap year where you went and got offered a unique position on a super yacht. Can you talk to us about that experience?
Mate, never in my life did I ever think that I'd live on a boat. And I got a phone call, and it was basically along the lines of, hey, there's this boat that's 50 meters long, owned by the owners of Anheuser-Busch. So that's like, you know, they own Stella and Corona and all those big beers, and then they own Burger King and stuff like that. Three very lovely, genuine Brazilian men. Anyway, so they use this boat for fishing and diving and cycling, and they go to these really remote locations in the world, and, you know, it's an all-male crew, and it's really a lot of fun. Would you be interested in coming on board and looking after the owners as the chief steward? And I was like, yep.
Silly question.
And it was a hard decision to do, because, like, I'd never been to sea, and I was such a – mate, I was an absolute fish out of water when I got on that boat. Like, the boys on the boat were looking at me going, who is this, like – hospo boy, hasn't got a blister on his hands, you know, all this sort of stuff. But, you know, I quickly learned my way. And I spent 2 years on that boat, mate. I spent 2 years traveling the world. I went to some of the most unique locations. I went, you know, went to fishing in St. Helena, which is a remote island off South Africa. It's a 7-day boat trip off South Africa. I went to spend three months in the Maldives, 4 months in Madagascar, and I got to go fishing. Every day. I went fishing every day. It was the best.
I mean, I was going to ask you, why did you leave Bluestone to go do this? But now I understand.
Yeah.
What an experience.
And I'll tell you what, like, you know, now, you know, 33 now, I've got a child and obviously all the businesses. I don't regret it at all. It was the best moment of my life. I got paid to travel the world, Phil. It was unbelievable.
That's an amazing experience. A little bit jealous. That's amazing, man. And so what made you essentially finish up and say, all right, I'm ready to come home?
I got homesick. Okay. I got homesick. I spent 2 years there. You know, being on a boat does a lot of strange things to a lot of men. And I just ultimately got really homesick, missed my family, missed my friends, started missing out on stuff, started missing out on weddings, started missing out on birthdays, time zones, just all sorts of stuff. And I just felt like I was at the age. I was 29. I was about to turn 30. Hadn't seen anyone. You know, I wanted to have a 30th birthday where I could, you know, see all my friends and family. And I just thought it was time. And I saw opportunity at home too. Everyone used to say to me when I was leaving the boat, like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I was adamant. I was so adamant that I was going to come and join Julian's team without even having the conversation with Julian. I was just clear that that was my goal. And I should say Julian and Christy Lee, Stewie and Nikki at that stage. But that's what I wanted to do. And I came home and we started the conversation, and I think it was about a month in, and I was on board.
So how was the connection with yourself and Julian?
Moose and I used to play junior football against one another.
Okay.
And it was fair to say that probably on the footy field we weren't the best of friends. But then we played in a few rep teams together, and we just over the years just chatted back and forth on different things about HOSPO, and we developed that mutual ground, and that's where we're at. And I've probably, you know, seen him every day of my life since I joined the team.
Wow. Yeah, I just, the genuine friendship you guys have is pretty beautiful to watch, because it's, you guys are in business together, but it's also, you see how much fun you're having. And there's so much I want to break down with the Only Hospitality Group. So you come back, you chat to Julian, you're adamant you're going to join Only Hospitality Group. Talk to us about the early days of your journey. Like, what was your role coming back to Only Hospitality?
Yeah, it was interesting. So when I came back, it was, we had, There was a need to provide assistance at a operational level in terms of HR management and talent management and operational support. So it was a role that Christy Lee had been handling prior to myself. That Christy Lee being Julian's wife, and she'd been in that capacity. And then I guess the business was beginning to expand. You know, Legacy had opened. There was Bentwood project was in the pipeline. Stanley was not far away, and they just needed another, I guess, leader to join the team. And so I joined the team, and it was sort of a forge your own path kind of thing. It was like, provide help and do what's required to help us succeed. And that was it. And you're right. We have had a lot of fun. We do continue to have a lot of fun.
And so once that role you're doing a bit of everything, Mr. Fix It, you know, if it's HR, if it's jumping in the store, managing teams, yep. You started as a GM, you're your chief operating officer. You're also a partner within the group. Talk to us about the difference in roles from general manager, what your roles were day to day compared to chief operating officer.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's a position of trust, right? And trust is earned. And when you become the chief operating officer, it's basically to make decisions on behalf of the business that are based on our goals, right? So if we have a goal to open this store by this deadline, I need to make decisions that Julian and the other partners would be comfortable with to help us achieve that timeline. When you're the general manager, I feel like you're managing the people and the day-to-day operations of the existing businesses. But when you're the chief operating officer, you're helping achieve the goals down the track. And it's only until, you know, you can build really good rapport, and that's what Julian and I have, that's probably a role that I was able to progress into. And obviously as the business grew, we had to bring in other leaders, and that's for us to mentor those leaders and help them achieve their you know, objectives.
And how do you guys deal with, as you grow and you got obviously yourself and Julian, you are great mates, but also there's a lot of pressure, a lot of money on the line. How do you deal with the decision making? You know, if you got one direction, he's got another, how does that work?
I think ultimately you just know your role. And you know your skill set, and you got to trust each other with when it comes to that. And you know, Julian is a fantastic visionary, and he's fantastic with finance and you know, construction projects and everything else like that. So I trust him with that, and probably, you know, he trusts me with the operational stuff and setting up the operations and building teams. And we just stick to our lane, I guess, is probably the best way to put it. And we just discuss everything. Everything's a very open, honest discussion. And we are big advocates for having robust discussions, because without robust discussions and sometimes disagreements, you're not going to progress. Mm. You know, we're not here to give each other a pat on the back every day. We're here to make ourselves better.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I mean, you got to have the hard conversations, right? As long as it's done with respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How is someone, I mean, the position of general manager and chief operating officer, if you're in hospitality, people want to grow and they want to get to that point. Where was it? I mean, how do you get to that point? Is it just kind of as much experience as possible, changing up different working? You worked, obviously, you know, in Lygon Street, then you went worked in Bluestone Lane. You obviously had some back-end experience with my guest list. What's the process to get to a position like yours?
I think it's, I guess when you move into an operational role in hospitality, it's a slow, I find in my journey, it's a slowly approach. So you might do 4 days on the tools and 1 day in an administration role. And then you might do 3 days on the tools and then 2 days in an administration role. And it's a slowly approach because you've got to be handing over the reins at a venue level to somebody else whilst taking on more work. And it's as you take on more work and you pile in the administration or general manager role increases, you need to train others around you. And I think it's just a slowly approach, you know, and it's about putting yourself out there and saying, hey, I want to learn more. I want to learn more. Can you explain this to me? Doing the extra hours. I think that, like, you know, the culture of counting hours, I think, stunts growth. And I feel like a lot of people want to count their hours at home when they're doing research or learning or whatever it might be, but all you're doing is investing in your future.
Yeah,
I love that. And investing in progress.
Yeah, I love that. And you hear so many people that have done that journey where they've gone and worked for free or they've gone to work with people for less money or they're doing whatever it takes because at the end of the day, it's going to come back and come back 10 times, right?
100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree anymore.
So the one thing, we spoke a little bit about the group and how much fun you guys have. The one thing I noticed on social media, and you guys are growing so quickly, how do you maintain that level of you guys are having so much fun. How does that culture, how do you get to that culture of where you're at now? I've never seen a group that has as much fun as they're having, but as much success as they're having as well.
No, that's nice. Thank you. Just don't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah.
You know, we are fun people. Just because, you know, I think, you know, just because we're growing doesn't mean that we all have to start wearing suits and sitting in an office. We're hospo people. We've come from working on the tools. We've always loved hospo because it's fun. And just because we're doing different things now doesn't mean it shouldn't be fun. But yeah, that's probably my best answer for that one.
And that culture obviously translate to the all your managers and your front of house staff and back of house staff in the shops, right? So I guess there's a couple of things I want to break down with this, with your group, where you have this great office culture, but then you go into your stores and you have obviously managers, chefs, and they're seeing what you're doing. So one, they can aspire to get to that level because they know there's a lot of growth, but how do you, how are you maintaining the quality and the standard as you grow? Because you guys are growing very quick.
Thanks, mate. I think that we spend a lot of time on the road, and each day I probably get to 6 or 7 stores, and Julian's the same, and our operations team are the same, and we all move around throughout the day, and it's about keeping an eye on the stores and stuff like that. I mean, obviously it's a bit different with COVID and all that sort of stuff, but it's about having touch points and jumping in there and helping out when they're under pressure and showing the team that we're all in it together and never asking somebody to do something. We're really big on never asking somebody to do something that we're not willing to do ourselves. It's something that we're really, really big on. Because nothing is beneath you as a leader. I think that, you know, the standards and stuff like that, we create systems and checklists. We're really big on systems and processes because we believe that whoever steps into the role should be capable of doing the role regardless of experience because there's a system and a set of instructions there for them to do. Obviously, you know, a barista or a chef, you know, you need to apply your trade and so forth. But if you're a server and you come into the venue and a manager asks you to, like, you know, pack down the back area of the venue because it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, There's a set of instructions on how to do it with photos, and this is how it's done and this is how it should look and stuff like that. Because you're right, you can't watch everything that everyone's doing. but you just got to trust in the systems and the processes.
Yeah, and how do you when you say trust in the processes and the systems, you know, obviously everyone wants to have systems and procedures, and a lot of people do, but then to execute them, how do you guys follow up on that? Is it the manager's duty to make sure they send you a checklist at the end of the day? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, so it's the venue manager's responsibility to maintain standards of the venue, and then the operations team, and in the operations team, there's obviously the general managers there too. It's the operations team to then do the checks on that, and they have each operational team member has a buddy that's a venue manager, so they have weekly meetings or contacts with them. It doesn't necessarily be face to face, but it's a phone call or it's a text message or whatever it might be. And then we use communication channels. So we have various different threads of communication that we communicate with our team on and stuff like that. And it's all about the collaborative learning when it comes to that. So, for example, if there's an issue, if there's a customer issue at a venue on a given day, that issue will go into the venue manager thread. And then as a team, we'll work through that issue and what the best outcome is. You know, Johnny from venue A might not have anything to do with the issue, but he's still learning about it, so that he can learn down the track on how to handle something.
Yeah, I love that. You guys have really kind of nailed the processes, like you said, the processes, the systems, the procedures, and I love that. And obviously with those means you can grow quite quickly. You've got, I mean, I think there's over 15 venues. You recently just bought a pub. You guys are about to open a restaurant, Too Good Talker. Talk to us about, obviously, a lot of your cafes are well-known, but talk to us about some of the new concepts, the pub and also the new restaurant you got coming up.
Yeah, so we actually got a new cafe opening up in a couple of weeks' time called Vermont General Store, which is we're really excited about. And we're opening another Juliet very shortly too. Again, at a park, and Juliet was our COVID model that we created last year. And this will be our sixth Juliet store. Coming from our nighttime experience in restaurants and bars as young hospitality workers, we always had the ambition to move into the nightlife space. And that's how the vision for a pub was born. We started looking at pubs probably 2 years ago now. And we've been looking at pubs, and then COVID came and everything else like that. And, you know, earlier this year we bought the Robbie Burns Hotel, which was actually one of the pubs that we first looked at. And that's how Hotel Collingwood was born. We bought the Robbie Burns. We traded it probably for about 5 or 6 weeks as the Robbie Burns, just to learn about the pub and the way that it operated and learn about the locals and build some rapport with the locals. And what we identified is that pub had a bit of an identity crisis. It was once a Spanish pub and now it's not, then it wasn't. And patrons were coming in like, is this a Spanish pub? Is this, you know, it was just no one knew what the pub was. So when we bought the Robbie Burns, the plan was to never change the name. And then we were like, well, we have to change the name. And that's how, and now we have Hotel Collingwood. So we opened Hotel Collingwood officially, I think 3 weekends ago for takeaway trade, and it was fantastic. It was a huge success, but unfortunately due to, you know, the restrictions that Melbourne is in, we've had to put that on hold. But with that comes another opportunity, and that's where Too Good Talker was born, which is another restaurant concept that we have. It's a freestyle Asian, restaurant that we're going to do, restaurant bar. And we're doing home meals cooked for home now throughout our venues, and we're doing a range of different pop-ups, sort of one night only at each location, and that's headed up by our kitchen team.
Yeah, I love that. And the diversity between your businesses, like you said, you got the restaurants, you got the pubs, you got the cafes, you got the lockdown model cafes, which obviously operate still quite well out of lockdown. You know, you got a butcher shop, I think it was, as well. You have a butcher, is it a meat shop?
Yeah, so we did a butcher pop-up just for the summer months last year.
Okay.
And that was great. That was an awesome concept, and it was a lot of fun. It was a butcher, grocer, and wine store. And we did that in the Malvern East precinct when everyone was sort of stuck right strictly within their sort of 3 to 5K radius. And it became a one-stop shop for everyone. You know, pop down to park, grab their meat, grab their seafood, grab their bottle of wine, grab their cheese. It was, we wanted it to be everything you want for a dinner party. And it was great. It was a really great success over summer.
I love that. How, sorry, go on.
No. Oh, good. Go on.
Yeah. How do you, when identifying a store, what are the things you look for? I mean, let's just say someone wants to go look for a cafe. I mean, obviously, restaurants are a different area, you know, location. It's all about location. But if you're looking for a cafe, what are the things you're looking for to see if it's a good spot?
You know, a good lease deal is really important. And it's about being thorough with that and making sure that, you know, you got to fall in love with the deal, not the idea of the deal or the location. That's really important. Because if the deal's not right, then the business isn't going to be right.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how good the business is.
It doesn't matter. And you know, you can go and take a site on Bourke Street Mall in Melbourne or, you know, Pitt Street, Sydney and pay ridiculous rents. But the deal, it's, you know, fall in love with the idea of having a cafe on a main street, but the deal's not going to be good because your rent's going to be too high.
Yeah, I think you guys have really nailed that, the balance between location but also the right commercial deals. What's the one thing you'd say to someone if they're looking at a shop, looking at a lease, what's the one thing they got to look out for?
I think the most important thing for me is don't sign too short a lease. Because if you sign a lease for 3 years or 5 years, it's going to be really hard to sell that business if you want to sell it, right? Because the purchaser of the purchasee of that business wants some security. So, you know, I think longer terms are important and trying to minimize that sort of here the bond required on that deal is important too because it's your capital. So sometimes it might be worth, you know, it depends if you need the capital to fit out the cafe, it might be worth paying fractionally a higher rent per month and a lower personal guarantee or bank guarantee on that.
Yeah. And the one thing I wanted to touch on a little bit as well, I mean, obviously we've spoken a little bit about leasing, about the right site. The one thing I think you guys do so well, and it's, I generally find people that are trying to save money don't give a great experience, and people that are giving a great experience sometimes aren't great with their money. You guys have found a great balance between really, like you said, attention to the financial details, but also you're giving a great experience to the guest. Talk to us about that wage cost and food, you know, cost of goods. How do you guys, what's your process in regards to keeping it strict and making sure that, you know, because at the end of the day, no matter how great the experience is, the business has to make money. What are you guys doing to make sure that your businesses stay profitable? What are the things you got in regards to wages and cost of goods?
Well, we invest in our financial and accounting team. That's the first thing that we do. That's a really important thing because each and every week we receive financial information on how the businesses are performing come Monday. So on a Monday afternoon, we have a complete view of how the store performed last week, and then we can adjust our ordering immediately. We look at our rosters daily and we look at forecasts on that. You know, there's so many factors that play into your rostering and your labor. And, you know, from a cafe perspective, like the weather is a big thing. You know, if it is raining cats and dogs, there's every chance that people aren't coming out. So, you know, reduce one staff member or back yourself in just to work that little bit harder to make that return. You know, and then vice versa, like on a day like today, you know, the sun's out, it's 24 degrees in Melbourne. People are out and about walking because that's what their activity at the moment. So all the cafes are going to be busier. So looking at the weather, looking at special events, that's a really important thing. Sorry, excuse me. So like is there local footy on? Is there a big AFL final on? Is there an NRL final on? Is the Olympics like, you know, 100-meter final on that day or whatever? These are things that sway people's behavior, and it's important to look at what's going on in the society. Like, you know, Boxing Day. Boxing Day is one of the biggest days of the year for trade in our venues. And the reason is because people are out and about shopping. They've had Christmas Day the day before. They're relaxed. They don't want to cook. They want to go out. That's a behavioral thing. It's about understanding people's behavior, and that's where you can really find benefit with your wages. Your cost of goods is about only ordering what you need. And ordering what you need, we follow a principle of just in time, not just in case. So we'd always, we want to be getting just to the end of, you know, the coffee, we want to be finishing with 1 kilo of coffee left over at the end of the week rather than, you know, 7 kilos. If you're left over with 7 kilos of coffee at the end of the week, that's, you know, 220, 230 bucks excess in your budget. Multiply that over the course of a year, that's 10 grand out of your pocket, right? That's a lot of money. So if you look after all of that along the way, you got to look at everything from an overall perspective too, and an annualized cost. I think that's important. We ran a wage report last week for the operational staff, just to show them what it looks like. You know, if a staff member finishes 15 minutes later, if a staff member finishes 30 minutes later, and a staff member finishes an hour later. And as an annualized cost, I think you know, an hour later would end up costing the business $100,000 a year.
Wow.
And that's, of course, across multiple stores. But it's important. We find it's really important information with the staff so that they understand the big picture. Mm. We don't hide anything. I don't think anyone should hide anything from the staff. You've got to empower people.
Yeah, I love that. And I think the fact that you guys are so open and telling your staff, you know, giving them that, being an open book, I think that makes things a lot easier. When they're going to keep that person for an extra half an hour, they're going to remember that presentation that you said, that where, hey, that's 100K a year, right? So,
yeah.
You spoke a little bit about the behavior, you know, looking at the behaviors and things like that. Is that something you guys are really investing a lot of time and money into now? Is that something you've learned over the years with your experience?
It's definitely a daily conversation, daily and weekly conversation, in the sense that, like, what are people doing at the moment? So, you know, the Too Good Talker, we launched Too Good Talker 2 weeks ago. It's been fantastic, and it's been great because it's allowed us to employ more people. It's allowed us to have some of those stood down staff return to work, but it's also given our loyal customers something new to look forward to during their week. And, you know, at the moment we're looking at the behavioural pattern of the orders. You know, are we getting more orders for 2 on a Wednesday and 4 on a Friday? And that's an indication that families are ordering it more on a Friday and couples are ordering it more midweek. You know, are we getting more sales on a Friday and Saturday as opposed to a Wednesday night? And of course, you know, naturally, you're going to always have a spike on the weekends, but we're looking at those sorts of behavioural patterns. We look at spend per head across our Juliet stores, and we observe the sort of the trends of what's happening in those stores and how people are spending. You know, are they coming and getting a coffee, or are they coming and getting a coffee and a pastry? It's really important to understand what the consumer's doing and understand the general mindset that in this COVID climate that we're unfortunately living in, understanding the consumer sentiment. And you know, it is governed, the media has a fair bit to play with it, but I think that other things are important too. And that's why we always sort of have, you know, upbeat music, staff well-presented, you know, greeting customers with a smile, because it's about making them feel really great in that moment. Because we can control how a customer feels when they walk into a store. And there's, you know, you would know as much as I know. You know, you walk into a cafe and the staff member doesn't want to know you. You're like, do I really want to get my coffee here?
100%, man. I agree.
You know.
So moving forward, and a couple more questions about own hospitality before we move on to some other topics. You've already mentioned that you're getting into the night trade. You know, you're doing great things. Like you said, you did a sausage sizzle at 5 of your stores. You've brought a lot of your staff back because of this. You're doing some great things. What's the future? Where do you see only hospitality in 5 years?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it's a dream. It's a goal and it's a dream of all ours to have 100 stores. And whether that's, you know, and I think that's a great starting short-term goal, probably a 3 to 3 year project, I'd say that would be. And I think that's a combination of cafes. It's a combination of Inglewood outlets. You know, we'll start opening up some Juliet coffee bars, Inglewood coffee bars across Melbourne when the CBD starts opening up. Pubs are high on the radar. We'll probably start investing in more pubs. And of course, restaurants. I think it's important to diversify the portfolio across the industry, because people go out for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. and late night. But I don't know that we'd ever get into a nightclub though.
I reckon you and Julian dancing at 2 a.m. would be.
I reckon we'd have a lot of fun.
Just not a great business.
might be hard backing up for the 6 a.m. wake up for the cafe.
That's true. Talking about Julian, I mean, you guys are always having a laugh on Instagram, and I always message him after he's always annoying you and having little tricks. Like, what's that relationship like? Is it you guys are having a lot of fun, right?
I think a lot of it's about the staff see it and the staff love it, and they realize that it's not all too serious, and we genuinely are great mates and we genuinely enjoy each other's company and we have a lot of fun. We spend a lot of time together outside of work. We've got very common interests and we've got great banter. I mean, don't worry, I've got my fair share. I just don't post all to social media. But I will say, like, sometimes I get folks walking down the street and they go, "Oh, you're Tony." And I was like, "Yeah." I was like, "How do you know?" And like, "Oh, I saw you in Julian's story last week." And I was like, "Oh, yeah, right. Here we go." It's always a bit of fun.
I said to Julian a while back, I was like, how is he still your mate?
Yeah. You're not the first person, but it's always a good laugh, mate. Honestly, it's always a good laugh.
Yeah, and like you said, you guys are great.
And if you can't laugh at yourself, what are you doing?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I totally agree. And you did touch on a little bit about the Inglewood coffee. That's something you guys use growing quite massively. I mean, you supply all your stores, but you also got a lot of wholesale clients. The idea of Inglewood coffee, what was the reason? I mean, it's a lot of work and very hard to start your own coffee company. What was the reason?
Yeah, I mean, Inglewood was born from the demand with internally. You know, Inglewood started 4 years ago, and I think we had 6 or 7 stores at the time, and it was about Corey Slater, who's our head roaster and green bean buyer at Inglewood. He wanted to start roasting coffee. Julian wanted to. They were like, okay, let's start trialing it. We were renting roasters at the time. You know, we were buying time on a roaster, and then, you know, we started growing, and then we started selling it to other venues across, you know, Melbourne and Sydney and Queensland. And then I guess, you know, that's where it was sort of born from. We've actually just moved locations. We've moved to a new warehouse out in Mount Waverley. It's 3,000 square metres. And we're moving our entire head office and roasting facility out there, which we're really excited about. It's going to be great. The whole, because previously the roastery was in North Coburg and head office was in Hawthorne, but now we're going to have the head office and the roastery all under the one roof. We're going to set up a little drive-through coffee business in that business park there too, so people will be able to get their takeaway coffee. And we're going to create our coffee academy out there. And, you know, Inglewood will just continue to grow and grow. We're so proud of that business. And we're really proud of what we've been able to achieve in a relatively short time.
Yeah, I love that, man. I think your growth is so inspiring, but I think it's because you guys are such great people. That's why it's so good to see. You've talked a lot about how great the culture is and how much fun you're having. One thing I always like to ask on, I guess, you know, on this podcast, because we want to know the truth, you know, the hard, the good, the bad. I want to talk a little bit about mental health and you know, have you gone through any tough periods in your life, or especially during hospitality? And if you have, how'd you get through it?
Look, I've been fortunate in the sense that I haven't had any mental health challenges. I mean, I think the topics are, it's such a difficult topic to discuss, because I feel like a lot of people are really misinformed on the topic. And I'm not one to say, to speak on the topic, to be honest with you, Phil. But what I do know is that when you have a bad day, it's just a bad day. And it doesn't mean that everything is falling apart. And I think what you do with that bad day is up to you, and how you respond to that is up to you. And what I mean by that is, if you have a really, like, this is how I live, right? And if I have a really bad day at work, I don't go home and crack a six-pack of beer and drink. I go home and I exercise because I feel like you got to change the way that you're feeling. You know, they say go for a swim in the ocean, change it, have a shower, go and exercise. If you can change the how you're feeling in that moment, the chances are you're going to have a better day the next day. It's not, that is absolutely not the recommendation to solving mental health, but that's how I try and approach it for myself. It is a concern. I really feel for the primary school kids and teenagers at the moment in the world that they're living in, and university students. And I think it's about, you know, we spoke about the power of positivity before. I mean, as leaders, we just have to be as positive as we can, and nurturing and supporting and being an ear and listening. But I think that's probably, you know, that's the best. We can only do the best that we can, right? But I do think it's important that people speak. Speaking to people is really important, because if you're not heard, you can often feel like you're not cared for, and everyone is cared for, and everyone is really a very important people. That's sort of my take on that topic.
Yeah, I know it's a very sensitive topic, but I think you've done really well explaining, you know, how you deal with, you know, a bad day and the things, you know, going through. Like you said, if you have a bad day and going home and having beers till you get drunk, it's not going to be the best way to deal with it, right? So I appreciate the way.
Well, you're starting the next day on the back foot, aren't you?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. So I think there's a lot of people that listen in the hospitality industry, which, you know, will start having a beer, then two, then three, and then gets to a point where it's out of control. So I think there's some really good advice there, Tones. As we start wrapping up and the conversation gets a bit lighter, one thing I love to ask everyone, I mean, my business and everything I've achieved has been on the back of mentors, and, you know, my dad was my first mentor, and then there's my brothers, and then so many great operators like yourself and Julian. Who's your biggest mentor?
You know, you told me that this question was coming, and I was thinking about, well, you know, I tried to have a really good think about it, and I think that from my, you know, what's important to me is obviously my family is very important to me, you know, my outlook on life is really important to me. And I'd say that a really big mentor that I have is actually my old captain from the boat, Wayne. You know, Wayne was the captain of the boat, and he had a really good outlook on life. And that was, it's all cool. It's all cool. It's all going to be okay. That was a really important thing. And that's sort of how I try and live my life in the sense of, like, it's all going to be okay. You know, I look to my family, you know, for a lot of inspiration and mentorship, and how, you know, I look at the adversities that my family had when they moved to Australia all those years ago from Italy, and, you know, they came here with nothing, and my normal Filippo opened the second pizza shop in Melbourne, that was Pantano's Pizza, and back in the day, which was obviously why I ended up in hospitality. And I think about the sacrifice. I think sacrifice is something that I learned from them, and hard work. And I think it just comes down to, like, you learn from leaders as they come into your life. You know, like, I think mentors, like Frank Dimattina, is a big mentor for me because he taught me how to look after people. You know, I think, you know, your bosses along the way in terms of your journey, they become your mentor. Well, they have become mentors for me. That's where I'm at.
I love that. It sounds like there's so many people that have kind of come into your life that have been mentors, from family and things like that. So, and is there, I mean, are you someone that, you know, do you love to listen to podcasts or read books? And if you do, is there one in particular that you really recommend from a book point of view?
Yeah, I do like to read. Look, my favorite all-time books are the Richard Branson books. You know, they were my all-time favorite books. And it was just because he had so much fun. He had so much fun, and he pushed the boundaries, and he did the things that people tell him he can't do. And I really feel that's sort of the mentality that I have when it comes to my career. You know, everyone always says, oh, you know, you won't get that venue open in 2 weeks' time, or, oh, you're opening tomorrow, the joint looks like a tip. And you know, he never got told no. And I don't never want to be told no. unfortunately, I don't spend a lot of time listening to podcasts in the car. I spend a lot of time on the phone. But I actually love music. I love to listen to music. So when I run, I listen to music, or when I'm out walking, I listen to music, or I have music playing in the house. I've always got music playing in the background.
Yeah, I love that, and it's the Richard Branson. You mentioned Richard Branson, and it's funny. As soon as you said that, I'm like, that's you guys. You guys is always having fun, and it's great that it's great to see that you guys are, and you're on that track of that success as well. I don't know if you're going to own your own airline one day, but I wouldn't pass.
Mate, I'd love to, but I don't think they make much money these days.
Actually, before we move on, I do want to touch on COVID a little bit.
Yeah, mate.
How has that affected? I mean, you personally, I know you know, like you said, you've been pretty blessed where you haven't had to deal with too much of that, you know, from a mental health side of things, but you're part of a business that, you know, that's got a lot of responsibilities. How has that affected you mentally?
Oh, look, you know, you can have bad days, you know, frustrating days, but you've got to keep pushing. And that's been the mentality. We've just got to keep pushing. We've got to keep reinventing ourselves. We've got to keep improving. Because it's about creating opportunity. You know, do I wish we were open? Yeah, absolutely. Do I understand what's going on? Yeah, I get it. Am I frustrated? Yeah, absolutely I am. Like, I want people in our venues more than anything. You know, we cannot wait to welcome people back and also, like, welcome life back, you know, see friends and family and go to birthdays and all the beautiful things that we live and go on holiday and all that stuff. But, look, we've been very fortunate in the sense that we're coffee, you know, and coffee is part of everyone's daily routine, particularly in Melbourne. I guess it's just been about, you know, finding opportunities has been what we've worked really hard on. And the Juliet was a really great opportunity, and the online sales for Inglewood was a really great opportunity. I had my first son during COVID, so that's sort of given me a lot of joy. He's Woody was born on Christmas Eve, so he's 8 months old now. So that's mate. To be honest with you, I've been busy. You know what it's like with kids, mate. They're just flat out.
Absolutely, and what a blessing it is to have a child come into the world where it kind of distracts you from the business side of things. Where, you know, you think of the positives, right?
Absolutely, mate. I walk in the front door at the end of the day, and he's just there with his smile, and you go, "How good's life?"
Yeah,
and you just go, "How good is it?"
And I mean, there's a couple of times I've asked you a bit of advice for people and anyone that's going through a hard time with COVID. What's the advice for that if someone's going through a tough time with COVID?
Talk to people. I think that's absolutely the most important thing. Talk to people. Write to your mate. You know, I've got a Facebook group with all my schoolmates, and, you know, somebody wrote this morning, like, that's schoolmates. I finished school in 2005, right? And, you know, someone wrote, "Hey, boys, like, news yesterday was pretty average. Is everyone feeling okay?" And people might not respond to that thread, but if somebody's really battling, he knows he can ring that person now and say, "Hey, mate, I'm actually having a shocker. Can we have a chat?" Yeah. Or, you know, "Can we have a Zoom?" Or, you know, stuff like that. So I think talking is really important. I think keeping active is really important. You know, there's nothing worse than just sitting down. You know, if you sleep too long, you get a sore back. If you sit on the couch for too long, you get a sore back. Keep active. Keep positive. I think that's really important. And set some goals. I think it's important to have goals during this period of time. And it might be as simple as, you know, "I want to do 100 push-ups in a row." Well, let's work towards that. Or, "I want to read this book by the end of the week." I think that's important, because if somebody is having a hard time, routine will help. I think routine is a really important thing for people.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And as we start wrapping up, I like to know, what advice would you give to someone that's about to open their first venue or is looking for their first venue? What advice would you give them?
Work hard. Honestly, that's I see people wanting to, reap the rewards really quickly. But nothing replaces hard work. You know, it's work hard. Enjoy it. Don't share your problems with your customers. I think that's a really important thing. Don't share your problems with your customers, because your customers have their own problems in life. And you want to make going to the cafe an experience, and a memorable experience, and a pleasurable experience. and give it everything, because it's you know, if it's your first cafe, there's every chance that that's all you got. And if it doesn't work, that's fine. Just get back on the bike, but give it your all and ask questions. Ask questions. Pick up the phone. You know, regularly we have people contact us and say, "Hey, mate, like I'm looking to open a cafe. Could you give me some advice?" People are willing to help. So ask questions. Ask for advice. And I encourage anyone that is looking to open their first cafe, give me a call. I'm you know, hit me up on Instagram. Hit me up on LinkedIn. Or you know, ask Phil for my email or whatever it might be. I'm always happy to help. I think asking questions is really important because I didn't know everything and I certainly still don't know everything about what I do. So I continue to ask questions and learn.
Yeah, and Tones, the one thing I can vouch for is you and Julian have always been there if I needed anything. So if it was a question or some advice or...
And likewise, mate, you've always been there for us.
Thanks, mate. I mean, there's not much I can offer, but... But I appreciate it. Thank you.
I don't think that, mate. I'm looking forward to seeing what you're about to achieve up in Penrith when we come up again. You got some pretty special stuff on the horizon up there, mate.
Yeah, no, very excited. And it's allowed me, I guess I've looked at people like yourselves and seen that, hey, you guys are able to achieve this and you guys give me the confidence to be able to do it as well. So talking about the future of venues, how do you see the future of hospitality?
I think it will really... the ordering at the table, the traditional method of waiters or waitrons taking orders at the table will fade away, and technology will improve systems and be a means to reduce labour costs in the industry. And I think that's a big thing. I think that there will be a shift towards more health conscious dining in the years to come. I think, you know, you can probably put a line through the last 2 years and that you'll see, you know, everyone's into their toasties and fried chicken sangers and all and lasagnas and all the feel good foods because that's all the people have. But I think once we move out of this COVID period, we'll become a really health conscious nation and a really active nation again, I think. No doubt in my mind there'll be a lot of out celebrating and long lunches and long dinners when we all come out of it. But I think when everything starts to correct itself and people start going on holidays and stuff like that, I think the industry will become really health conscious.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it was moving towards that direction anyway, but I think this is going to kind of fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw a business the other day. It was really sad. They've shut down. It's called Blue Bag in the CBD. And they did amazing salads, mate. You'd go in and you build your own sort of salad and you get it for $10 or $12, whatever it is, and take it to your office. And, you know, I think we'll see a lot more of that stuff come back in over the years to come. But that was I was pretty disappointed to see when that shut down because they were a great business. And, you know, a lot of businesses, unfortunately, have shut down over this period of time. And it's really sad. And, you know, my heart goes out to those operators. And I'm just look, to be frank with you, Phil, mate, I'm so appreciative that, you know, we're still going and, you know, still being able to employ people and put food on our plates and everything else like that and give new people opportunity. I'm personally very thankful.
Yeah, that gratitude and gratefulness you have is essentially why you guys are where you're at, because you're constantly grateful and you're doing things to keep your staff employed. And what's a venue? You can't pick any of your own venues. What's one venue that you love going to in Melbourne? outside of only hospitality,
I'll give you a cafe, a restaurant, and a pub.
All right.
So Barton Street Milk Bar in Hawthorne is a cafe I love going to. It's just nice. It's right next to a footy oval, little community. Go down there, grab a coffee, go for a walk around the park. I love going there. It's my favorite cafe.
What was the name of that one, sorry?
Barton Street Milk Bar in Hawthorne.
Barton Street.
My favorite restaurant is Long Grain in the Melbourne CBD. It's a fantastic Thai restaurant, great cocktail list, great wine list, delicious food. Love going there. It's a special occasion place that we go to. And then my favorite pub is the Spread Eagle in Richmond. That's my local. It's just a great locals pub, you know, and it's, you know what? And I love it because the hospitality is amazing. Mm. you know, Ali, the venue manager, the GM of the business and one of the owners, she makes it amazing. You know, she does the meat tray raffle and she does the trivia, and it's always just a good time when you go there, and it's about a sense of community. So they're my three venues for you.
And what's your favorite own hospitality venue?
Oh, look, the pub is, I love the pub. You know, Hotel Collingwood is just amazing. But my favorite only hospitality venue is Winter. That was the first venue that I became a partner in. It was my first, it was the first venue that I was an owner in. And you know, I was involved in the build of that a lot. And it's where I guess my journey as a business owner began. So it's always going to be and hold a very special place in my heart, because you never forget your first, right?
Oh, 100%. And that's exactly how I am with Percy's. It's like my third child. So.
Yeah, exactly. And for Moose, it's probably Mob, you know, or even an annoying brother. But, you know, it's like your first child and you just hold on to them so tightly.
Yeah, so true. And what's, talking about venues, what's one thing you want, at least one thing you want people to say about your venue after they've visited?
That they had fun.
All right. So my last question on every podcast that I like to ask is from Guy Raz, How I Built This. And he asks all the final questions to his guests is, how much of your success do you put down to hard work and how much to good luck?
I believe that you make your own luck. And that's how everything I've achieved in my life has been hard work. My education, my sport, my work, my travel experience, it's all been hard work. But, you know, I'd probably say 70 hard work, 30 luck, because you've got to have luck. You've always got to have a little luck. What about you?
Man, I find it's funny. A few people ask me that question. I think my answer's changed a few different times, but I think for me, we'd never be lucky if we didn't put ourselves in the position that we put ourselves in, right? Like we can be as lucky as, you know, you go buy a ticket, you go buy a ticket for a lottery, you got to still go out there and buy the ticket, right? Like you can't just hope it's going to fall in your lap. So put the work in and then the luck, you seem to get a lot luckier. So.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And you got to be willing to take risks, right, to get lucky.
Oh, 100%. If you're not taking the risks, then, you know, to get lucky, take the risks, it means, you know, it's a lot more hard work there as well. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, Tony, look, like I said, like every time, I really appreciate your time and you're so happy to give me the time you need, you know, a bit more background about yourself and all the time and I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Mate, thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share my story and I hope that, your listeners have enjoyed it and mate, it's a real pleasure to chat with you and I can't wait to catch up with you when the time's right.
I'm going to give you a big hug when I see you, brother.
100%. Chat to you soon, mate.
Chat soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.